of Jeanette Marie Fultz of South Chelsea, and then the Right Honorable Edmund F. Haney Facility for Demonstrably Incorrigible Girls down in Brockton. And in Pat's office, with the door only half shut, Jeanette gave her face the blandly hostile expression she wore around upscale boys with no tats and all of their teeth, that outside of N.A. wouldn't have interest in her or might view her lack of front teeth and nose pin as evidence of they were, like, better than her and like that somehow. It emerged this kid didn't seem like he had enough emotional juice to be interested in judging anybody or even noticing them, however. His talking had a burbly, over-salivated quality Jeanette knew all too wicked well, the quality of somebody who just lately put down the pipe and or bong. The kid's hair was starting to melt in the heat of Pat's office and drip and settle on his head like a slashed tire, causing that his face got bigger. He looked a little like what the fourth Mrs. Fultz had called green around the gills. The boy stood there very straight with his hands behind his back and said he lived nearby and had for some time been interested in sort of an idle, largely speculative way in considering maybe dropping in on some sort of Substance Anonymous meeting and everything like that, basically as just something to do, the exact same roundabout denial shit as persons without teeth. And said, but he didn't know where any were, any meetings, or when, and but knew the Ennett House was nearby.
323.
That dealt directly with anonymous organizations of this sort, and was wondering whether he maybe could have or borrow and Xerox and promptly return by either E or fax or first class mail, whichever they might prefer, some sort of relevant meeting schedule. He apologized for intruding and said, but he didn't know whom else to call. The sort of guy like Ewell and Day and Snotty look right through you if you weren't a fucking cover girl, Ken E, that knew how to long divide and say whom, but didn't even know how to look up shit on the yellow pages. Much later, in subsequent events light, Jeanette F. would clearly recall the sight of the boy's frozen hair slowly settling, and how the boy had said whom, and the sight of clear upscale odor-free saliva almost running out over his lower lip as he fought to pronounce the word without swallowing.
324.
Technical interviewers, under Chief of Unspecified Services, are the G. Tyne.
325.
Really do this. Bring a portable high-watt lamp and plug it in and adjust its neck so the light shines down directly on the face of the interview's subject, whose Homburg and shade-affording eyebrows had been removed by polite but emphatic request. And it was this, the harsh light on her fully exposed post-Marxist face, more than any kind of tough, noir-informed grilling from R. Tyne Jr. and the other technical interviewer, that prompted MIT, ABD, PhD, Molly Notkin, fresh off the NNYC high-speed rail, seated in the Sidney Peterson-shaped directorial chair amid dropped luggage in her co-op's darkened and lock-dickied living room, to spill her guts, roll over, eat cheese, sing like a canary, tell everything she believed she knew.
326.
Molly Notkin tells the USOUS operatives that her understanding of the après-garde auteur J.O. Incandenza's lethally entertaining Infinite Jest, number 5 or 6, is that it features Madame Psychosis as some kind of maternal instantiation of the archetypal figure Death, sitting naked, corporeally gorgeous, ravishing, hugely pregnant, her hideously deformed face either veiled or blanked out by undulating computer-generated squares of color or anamorphosized into unrecognizability as any kind of face by the camera's apparently very strange and novel lens, sitting there, nude, explaining in very simple childlike language to whomever the film's camera represents that death is always female, and that the female is always maternal. That is, that the woman who kills you is always your next life's mother. This, which Molly Notkin said didn't make too much sense to her either when she heard it, was the alleged substance of the death cosmology Madame Psychosis was supposed to deliver in a lilating monologue to the viewer, mediated by the very special lens. She may or may not have been holding a knife during this monologue, and the film's big technical hook, the auteur's films always involved some sort of technical hook, involved some very unusual kind of single lens on the Bolex H-32's turret.
327.
And it was unquestionably an FX that Madame Psychosis looked pregnant, because the real Madame Psychosis had never been visibly pregnant. Molly Notkin had seen her naked.
328.
And you can always tell if a woman's ever carried anything past the first trimester if you look at her naked.
329.
Molly Notkin tells them that Madame Psychosis's own mother had killed herself in a truly ghastly way with an ordinary kitchen garbage disposal on the evening of Thanksgiving Day in the year of the Tuck's medicated pad, 4 odd months before the film's auteur himself had killed himself, also with a kitchen appliance, also ghastlyly, which she says, though any Lincoln-Kennedy-type connections between the two suicides will have to be ferreted out by the interviewers on their own, since as far as Molly Notkin knew, the two different parents didn't even know of each other's existence. That the lethal cartridge's digital Bolex H-32 camera, already a Rube Goldberg-esque amalgam of various improvements and digital adaptations to the already modification-heavy classic Bolex H-16 Rex 5, a Canadian line, by the way, favored throughout his whole career by the auteur, because its turret could accept 3 different seamount lenses and adapters. That Infinite Jest 5, or 6s, had been fitted with an extremely strange and extrusive kind of lens, and lay during filming on either the floor or like a cot, or bed, the camera, with Madame Psychosis as the death mother figure inclined over it, parturient and nude, talking down to it, in both senses of the word, which, from a critical perspective, would introduce into the film a kind of synesthetic double entendre, involving both the aural and visual perspectives of the subjective camera, explaining to the camera, as audience synecdoche, that this was why mothers were so obsessively, consumingly, drivenly, and yet somehow narcissistically loving of you, their kid. The mothers are trying frantically to make amends for a murder neither of you quite remember. Molly Notkin tells them she could be far more helpful and forthcomingly detailed if only they'd switch that beastly lamp off or train it someplace else, which is a brass-faced falsehood, and dismissed as such by Tyne Jr. And so the light stays right on Molly Notkin's glabrous, unhappy face. That Madame Psychosis and the film's auteur had not been sexually enmeshed, and for reasons beyond the fact that the auteur's belief in a finite world total of available erections rendered him always either impotent or guilt-ridden, that in fact Madame Psychosis had loved and been sexually enmeshed only with the auteur's son, who, though Molly Notkin never encountered him personally, and Madame Psychosis had taken care never to speak ill of him, was clearly as thoroughgoing a little rotter as one would find down through the whole white male canon of venery, moral cowardice, emotional chicanery, and rot. That Madame Psychosis had been present neither at the auteur's suicide nor at his funeral. That she'd missed the funeral because her passport had expired. That nor had Madame Psychosis been present at the reading of the late auteur's will, despite the fact that she was one of the beneficiaries. That Madame Psychosis had never mentioned the fate or present disposition of the unreleased cartridge entitled either Infinite Jest No. 5 or Infinite Jest No. 6, and had described it only from the perspective of the experience of performing in it, nude, and had never seen it, but had a hard time believing it was even entertaining, let alone lethally entertaining, and tended to believe it had represented little more than the thinly veiled cries of a man at the very terminus of his existential tether, the auteur having apparently been extremely close to his own mother in childhood, and had no doubt been recognized as such by the auteur, who, though not exactly the psychic sea's steadiest keel, had been in many respects an acute reader and critic of film, and would have been able to distinguish the real filmic McCoy from pathetic cries veiled as film, no matter how wildly his nautical compass was spinning around on its tether, and would, in all probability, have destroyed the master print of the failed piece of art, the same way he'd reportedly destroyed the first 4 or 5 failed attempts at the same piece, which pieces had admittedly featured actresses of lesser mystique and allure.
That the auteur's funeral had purportedly taken place in Lille province of Nouveau-Quebec, the birth province of the auteur's widow, featuring an interment and not a cremation. That, far be it from her to tell the U.S. Office of Unspecified Services its business, but why not simply go to J.O.I.'s widow and verify directly the existence and location of the purported cartridge?
It seemed pretty unlikely to her, Molly Notkin, that the auteur's widow had any connections with any anti-American groups, cells, or movements, no matter what the files in her indiscreet youth might suggest, since from everything Molly Notkins heard, the woman didn't have much interest in any agendas larger than her own individually neurotic agendas, even though she came on to Madame Psychosis all sweet and solicitous. That, Madame Psychosis had confessed to Molly Notkin that the widow struck her as very possibly death incarnate, her constant smile, the rictal smile of some kind of thanatoptic figure, and that it struck Madame Psychosis as bizarre that it was she, Madame Psychosis, whom the auteur kept casting as various feminine instantiations of death, when he had the real thing right under his nose, an eminently photogenic to boot, the widow to be, apparently a real restaurant silencer-type beauty even in her late 40s. The auteur had stopped ingesting distilled spirits as Madame Psychosis's personal condition for consenting to appear in what she knew to be her, but did not know to be the J.O.I.'s, final film cartridge, and that the auteur had, apparently, incredibly,
330,
kept his side of the bargain. Possibly because he'd been so deeply moved at M.P.'s consent to appear before the camera again, even after her terrible accident and deformation, and the little rotter of a son's despicable abandonment of the relationship under the excuse of accusing Madame Psychosis of being sexually enmeshed with their, here, Molly Notkin said, that she, of course, had meant to say his father, the auteur, and that the auteur had apparently remained alcohol-free for the whole next 3.5 months, from Xmas of the year of the Tuck's medicated pad to the 1st of April of the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, the date of his suicide. That, the completely secret and hidden substance abuse problem, the one that had now landed Madame Psychosis in an elite private dependency treatment facility so elite that not even MP's closest friends knew where it was, beyond knowing only that it was someplace far, very far away, that the abuse problem could have been nothing but a consequence of the terrible guilt Madame Psychosis felt over the auteur's suicide, and constituted a clear unconscious compulsion to punish herself with the same sort of substance abuse activity she had coerced the auteur into stopping, merely substituting narcotics for wild turkey, which Molly Notkin could attest was some very gnarly-tasting liquor indeed. Know that Madame Psychosis's guilt over the auteur's felodicelf had nothing to do with the purportedly lethal infinite jest, number 5 or number 6, which, as far as Madame Psychosis had determined from the filming itself, was little more than an ola podrida of depressive conceits strung together with flashy lensmanship and perspectival novelty. That, no, rather the consuming guilt had been over the condition that the auteur suspend the ingestion of spirits, which it turned out, MP had claimed in deluded hindsight, had been all that was keeping the man's tether raveled, the ingestion, such that without it he was unable to withstand the psychic pressures that pushed him over the edge into what Madame Psychosis said she and the auteur had sometimes referred to as, quote, self-erasure. That it did not strike her, Molly Notkin, as improbable that the special limited edition turkey-shaped gift bottle of Wild Turkey blended whiskey brand distilled spirits with the cerise velveteen gift ribbon around its neck, with a bow tucked under its wattles on the kitchen counter next to the microwave oven before which the auteur's body had been found so ghastlyly inclined, had been placed there by the spouse's widow-to-be, who may well have been enraged by the fact that the auteur had never been willing to give up spirits, quote, for her, but had apparently been willing to give them up, quote, for Madame Psychosis and her nude appearance in his final opus. That the, by all reports, exceptionally attractive Madame Psychosis had suffered an irreparable facial trauma on the same Thanksgiving day that her mother had killed herself with a kitchen appliance, leaving her, Madame Psychosis, hideously and improbably deformed, and that her membership in the Union of the Hideously and Improbably Deformed's 13-step self-help organization was no kind of metaphor or ruse. that the intolerable stresses leading to the auteur's self-erasure had probably way less to do with film or digital art. This auteur's anti-confluential approach to the medium having always struck Molly Notkin as being rather aloof and cerebrally technical, to say nothing of naively post-Marxist in its self-congratulatory combination of anamorphic fragmentation and anti-picaresque narrative stasis.
331.
Or with having allegedly spawned some angelic monster of audience gratification, anyone with a nervous system who watched much of his oeuvre could see that fun or entertainment was pretty low on the late filmmaker's list of priorities, but rather much more likely to do with the fact that his widow-to-be was engaging in sexual enmeshments with just about everything with a Y chromosome, and had been for what sounded like many years, including possibly the auteur's son and Madame's craven lover as a child, seeing as it sounded like the little rotter had enough malcathected issues with his mother to keep all of Vienna humming briskly for quite some time. That thus, with the Promethean guilt angle on the auteur's suicide cast into serious doubt, there was little question in ABD Dr. Notkin's mind that the entire perfect entertainment as Liebestod myth surrounding the purportedly lethal final cartridge was nothing more than a classic illustration of the antinomically schizoid function of the post-industrial capitalist mechanism, whose logic presented commodity as the escape from anxieties of mortality, which escape is itself psychologically fatal, as detailed in perspicuous detail in Monsieur Gilles Deleuze's posthumous Incest and the Life of Death in Capitalist Entertainment, which he'd be happy to lend the figure standing up somewhere above the lamp's white fire, one of them tapping something irritatingly against the lamp's conic metal shade, if they'd promise to return it and not mark it up. That, in response to respectful but pointed requests to keep the responses on some sort of factual track and spare them all the egg-headed abstractions, Madame Psychosis's deforming trauma in its combination of coincidence and malefic intention had been like something right out of the auteur's most ghastly and unresolvable proto-incestuous disaster films. For example, The Night Wears a Sombrero, Dial C for Concupiscence, and The Unfortunate Case of Me. That, Madame Psychosis, an only child, had been extremely and heartwarmingly close to her father, a low-pH chemist for a Kentucky reagent outfit, who'd apparently had an extremely close only child and watching movies together-based relationship with his own mother, and seemed to reenact the closeness with Madame Psychosis, taking her to movies on a nearly daily basis in Kentucky, and driving her all over the Mid-South for various junior baton-twirling competitions, while his wife, Madame Psychosis's mother, a devoutly religious but wounded and neurasthenic woman with a fear of public spaces, stayed home on the family farm, canning preserves and seeing to the administration of the farm, etc. But that things had gotten first strange and then creepy as Madame Psychosis entered puberty, apparently. Specifically, the low pH father had gotten creepy, seeming to behave as if Madame Psychosis were getting younger instead of older, taking her to increasingly child-rated films at the local Cineplex, refusing to acknowledge issues of menses or breasts, strongly discouraging dating, etc. Apparently, issues were complicated by the fact that Madame Psychosis emerged from puberty as an almost freakishly beautiful young woman, especially in a part of the United States where poor nutrition and indifference to dentition and hygiene made physical beauty an extremely rare and sort of discomforting condition, one in no way shared by Madame Psychosis's toothless and fireplug-shaped mother, who said not a word as Madame Psychosis's father interdicted everything from brassieres to pap smears. Addressing the nubile Madame Psychosis in progressively puerile baby talk and continuing to use her childhood diminutive like Pookie or Putty as he attempted to dissuade her from accepting a scholarship to a Boston university whose film and film cartridge studies program was, he apparently maintained, full of, quote, nasty pootum wookie bam-bams, unquote, whatever family code pejorative this signified. That, to cut to a chase which the interviewer's hands-on-hip attitudes and replacement of the lamp's bulb with a much higher wattage signified they'd very much like to see cut to, as is often the case, it wasn't until Madame Psychosis got to college and gradually acquired some psychic distance and matter for emotional comparison, that she even began to see how creepy her reagent daddy's regression had been. And not until a certain major sports star's son's autograph on a punctured football inspired more emailed suspicion and sarcasm than gratitude from home in Kentucky, that she began even to suspect that her lack of social life throughout puberty might have had as much to do with her daddy's intrusive discouragement as with her actianizing pubescent charms. That, pausing briefly to spell actianizing, the shit had hit the intergenerational psychic fan when Madame Psychosis brought the auteur's little rotter of a son home to the Kentucky spread for the third time, for Thanksgiving in the year of the Tuck's medicated pad, and witnessing her daddy's infantilizing conduct of her and her mother's wordless, compulsive canning and cooking, not to mention the terrific tension that resulted when Madame Psychosis attempted to move some of the stuffed animals out of her room to make room for the auteur's son, in short, experiencing her home and daddy through the comparative filter of enmeshment with the auteur's son, brought Madame Psychosis to the crisis that precipitates speaking the unspeakable. And that it had been at Thanksgiving dinner, at midday on the 24th of November, YTMP, when the low-pH daddy began not only cutting up Madame Psychosis's plate's turkey for her, but mashing it into puree between the tines of his fork, all under the raised comparative eyebrows of the auteur's son, that Madame Psychosis finally aired the unspoken question of why. With her now of legal age and living with a male, and retired from childhood's twirling and carving out an adult career on one and potentially two sides of the film camera, did her own personal daddy seem to feel that she needed help to chew? Molly Notkin's secondhand take on the emotional eruptions that ensued is not detailed, but she feels she can state with confidence that it's plausibly a case of any kind of system that's been under enormous silent pressure for some time, that when the system finally blows, the accreted pressure's such that it's almost always a full-scale eruption. The low-pH daddy's enormous stress had apparently erupted right there at the table, with his grown daughter's white meat between his tines, in the confession that he'd been secretly, silently, in love with Madame Psychosis from way, way back. That the love had been the real thing, pure, unspoken, genuflectory, timeless, impossible. That he never touched her, wouldn't, nor ogle, less out of a horror of being the sort of Mid-South father who touched and ogled, than out of the purity of his doomed love for the little girl he'd escorted to the movies as proudly as any beau, daily. That the repression and disguisability of his pure love hadn't been all that hard when Madame Psychosis had been juvenile and sexless, but at the onset of puberty and nubility, the pressure had become so great that he could compensate only by regressing the child mentally to an age of incontinence and pre-mashed meat, and that his awareness of how creepy his denial of her maturation must have seemed, even though neither the daughter nor mother, even now wordlessly chewing a candied yam, had remarked on it, the denial and creepiness, although the man's beloved pointers were given to whimper and scratch at the door when the denial had gotten especially creepy, animals being way more sensitive than humans to emotional anomalies, in Molly Notkin's experience, had raised his internal limbic system's pressure to near intolerable foot-kilo levels, and that he'd been hanging on for dear life for the past, nigh on now, a decade, but that now that he'd had to actually stand witness to the removal of Pookie and Urgle Bear and others from her ballerina wallpapered room to make space for a non-related mature male whose physical vigor through the peephole the daddy'd exerted every gram of trembling will he'd possessed, trying not to drill the hole in the bathroom wall just above the mirror, over the sink, whose pipes made the wall behind the headboard of Madame Psychosis's room's bed sing and clunk, and through which, late at night, claiming to mother a case of skitters from all the holiday nibbles, hunched atop the sink, every night since Madame Psychosis and the auteur's son had first arrived to sleep together in the unstuffed, animaled bed of a childhood, through which he'd been all but tortured by the purity of his impossible love for the... That it had been at this point that Madame Psychosis's mother's fork and then whole plate had clattered to the floor, and that, amid the sounds of the pointers under the table fighting over that plate, the mother's own denial system's pressure blew, and she freaked. Announcing publicly at the table that she and the daddy had not once known each other as man and wife since Madame Psychosis had first menstruated. That she'd known something incredibly creepy was going on but had denied it, evacuated her suspicions, and placed them under great pressure in the bell jar of her own denial because, she admits, is probably less accurate than something like keens or shrieks or jabbers, that her own father, an itinerant camp-meeting preacher, had molested her and her sister all through childhood, ogled and touched and worse, and that this had been why she'd married at just 16, to escape, and that now it was clear to her that she'd married the exact same kind of monster, the kind who spurns his ordained mate and wants his daughter. She'd said maybe it was her, she, the mother, who was the monster, which, if so, she was tired of hiding it and appearing falsely before God and man. Whereupon she'd reeled from her place and hurtled three pointers and run down to the daddy's acid lab in the cellar to disfigure herself with acid. That the daddy'd kept a world-class collection of various acids in Pyrex brand flasks on wooden shelves down in the cellar. That the daddy, the rotter of a son, and finally a shock slowed Madame Psychosis, had all run down the stairs after the mother and hit the cellar just as the mother had removed the stopper of a Pyrex flask with an enormous, half-eaten-away skull on the side, which along with the flaming scarlet piece of litmus paper afloat inside signified an incredibly low pH and corrosive type of acid. That Madame Psychosis's name was, in reality, Lucille Duquette, and the daddy's name either Earl or Al Duquette of extreme southeast Kentucky, way down near Tennessee and Virginia. That despite the little rotter's professions of self-recrimination for allowing the deformity to take place, and claimed that the swirling systems of guilt and horror and denial-informed forgiveness made a committed relationship with Madame Psychosis increasingly untenable, it didn't take an expert in character disorders and weaknesses to figure out why the fellow'd given Madame Psychosis the boot within months of the traumatic deformity, now did it. That right on the hysterical cusp, where internalized rage can so easily shift to externalized rage, the mother had hurled the low pH flask at the daddy, who'd reflexively ducked, and that the rotter, one Oren, right behind, a former tennis champion with superb upper body reflexes, had instinctively ducked also, leaving Madame Psychosis, dazed and bradykinetic from the sudden venting of so many high-pressure repressive family systems, open for a direct facial hit, resulting in the traumatic deformity. And that it had been everyone's failure to press any charges that had liberated the mother from southeast Kentucky custody and allowed her access once again to her home's kitchen, where, apparently despondent, she committed suicide by putting her extremities down the garbage disposal. First one arm and then, kind of miraculously if you think about it, the other arm.
332.
The most distant and obscure Tuesday PM meeting listed in the little white Metro Boston Recovery Options booklet.
333.
The incisorless, nostril-pierced girl down at the Ennett House had given him, looked to be a males-only thing, at 17:30 hours, out in Natick, almost in Framingham, at something with a location on Route 27 that the MBRO booklet listed only as QRS-32A. Hal, who had no last class period, rushed through PMs, dispatching Shaw 1 and 3 by the time the regular PMs were even warming up, then skipping left-leg circuits in the weight room, and was also foregoing tonight's lemon chicken with potato rolls, all to blast out to Natick in time to check this anti-substance fellowship meeting business out. He wasn't sure why, since it didn't seem to be any kind of slobbering inability to abstain that was the problem. He hadn't had so much as a milligram of a substance, of any kind, since the 30-day urological condemnation of last week. The issues, the horrific way his head's felt, increasingly, since he abruptly abandoned all hope.
334.
It wasn't just nightmares and saliva. It was as if his head perched on the bedpost all night now, and in the terribly early a.m. when Hal's eyes snapped open immediately said, "Glad you're up. I've been wanting to talk to you." And then didn't let up all day. Having at him like a well-revved chainsaw all day until he could finally try to fall unconscious, crawling into the rack, wretched, to await more bad dreams. 24/7s of feeling wretched and bereft. Dusk was coming earlier. Hal signed out at the portcullis and blasted down the hill and took the tow truck up Commonwealth Avenue to the CC Reservoir and then south on Hammond, the same deadening route as the ETA conditioning run, except when he hit Boylston Street, he turned right and struck out west. Once it cleared West Newton, Boylston Street became Shunpike Route 9, the major west suburb commuter alternative to the suicidal I-90, and 9 suburb-hopped serpentine all the way west to Natick and Route 27. Hal crawled through traffic on a major flow road that had once been a cowpath. By the time he was in Wellesley Hills, the sky's combustion-ish orange had deepened to the hellish crimson of a fire's last embers. Darkness fell with a clunk shortly after, and Hal's spirits with it. He felt pathetic and absurd even going to check this Narcotics Anonymous meeting thing out. Everybody always flashed his or her brights at the tow truck because the headlamps were set so senselessly high on the truck's grill. The little portable disc player had been detached by either Pemulus or Axford and not returned. WYYY was a ghostly thread of jazz against a sea of static. AM had only corporate rock and reports that the General Administration had scheduled and then canceled a special spontaneous disseminated address to the nation on subjects unknown. NPR had a kind of roundtable on potential subjects. George Will's laryngectomy prosthesis sounded hideous. Hal preferred silence and traffic sounds. He ate 2 of 3 $4 brand muffins he'd whipped in for at a Cleveland Circle gourmet bakery, grimacing as he swallowed because he'd forgotten a tonic to wash them down. And then put in a mammoth plug of Kodiak and spat periodically into his special NASA glass, which fit neatly into the cup holder down by the transmission, and passed the last 15 minutes of the dull drive, considering the probable etymological career of the word anonymous, all the way he supposed from the Aeolic Ovia through Tyne's B.S. 1580s reference to Anonymal Chronicles, and whether it was joined way back somewhere at the Saxonic taproot to the Old English on ane, which supposedly meant all as one or as one body, and became Cynewulf's eventual standard inversion to the classic anon, maybe. Then called up on his mnemonic screen the developmental history since B.S. 35 of the initial substance group AA, on which there'd been such a lengthy entry in the discursive OED that Hal hadn't had to hit any sort of outside database to feel more or less factually prepared to drop into its spin-off NA and at least give the thing an appraising once-over. Hal can summon a kind of mental Xerox of anything he'd ever read and basically read it all over again, at will, which talent the abandonment of hope hasn't, so far, compromised, the withdrawal's effects being more like emotional/salivo-digestive. The rock faces on either side of the truck when 27 goes through blasted hills of rock, the very fringes of the Berkshire's penumbra, are either granite or gneiss. Hal, for a while, also practices saying, "My name's Mike." "Mike, hi." "Hey there, name's Mike," etc., into the truck's rear view. By 15 minutes east of Natick, it becomes obvious that the little booklet's terse QRS designates a facility called Quabbin Recovery Systems, which is easy to find. Roadside ad signs starting to announce the place several clicks away, each sign a little different and designed to form a little like narrative of which actual arrival at QRS would be the climax. Even Hal's late father was too young really to remember Burma Shave signs. Quabbin Recovery Systems is set far back from Route 27 on a winding, groomed gravel road, flanked all the way up by classy old-time standing lanterns, whose glass shades are pebbled and faceted like candy dishes, and seemed more for mood than illumination. Then the actual building's driveways, an even more winding little road that's barely more than a tunnel, through meditative pines and poor postured Lombardy poplars. Once off the highway, the whole nighttime scene out here in Exurbia, Boston's true boonies, seems ghostly and circumspect. Hal's tires crunch cones in the road. Some sort of bird shits on his windshield. The driveway broadens gradually into a like delta, and then a parking lot of mint white gravel, and the physical QRS is right there, cubular and brooding. The building's one of these late-model, undeformed cubes of rough paneled brick and granite coins. Illuminated, moodily, from below by more classy lanterns, it looks like a building block from some child titan's toy chest. Its windows are the smoky brown kind that in daylight become dark mirrors. Hal's late father had publicly repudiated this kind of window glass in an interview in Lens and Pain when the stuff first came out. Right now, lit from inside, the windows have a sort of bloody, polluted aspect. A good 2/3 of the lot's parking places say reserved for staff, which strikes Hal as odd. The tow truck tends to diesel and chuff after de-ignition, finally subsiding with a shuddering fart. It's dead quiet except for the hiss of light traffic down on 27 past all the trees. Only TP-Link workers and marathon-type commuters live in exurban Natick. It's either way colder out here or else a front's been coming in while Hal drove. The lot's piney air has the ethyl sting of winter. QRS's big doors and lintel are more of that reflector shade glass. There's no obvious bell, but the doors are unlocked. They open in that sort of pressurized way of institutional doors. The savanna-colored lobby is broad and still and has a vague medical-slash-dental smell. Its carpet's a dense, low, tan, dacrenile weave that evacuates sound. There's a circular, high-countered nurse's station or reception desk, but nobody's there. The whole place is so quiet, Hal can hear the squeak of blood in his head. The 32A that follows QRS in the girl's little white booklet is presumably a room number. Hal has on a non-ETA jacket and carries the NASA glass he spits in. He'd have to spit, even if he didn't have chew in. The Kodiak's almost like a cover or excuse. There is no map or "you are here" type directory on view in the lobby. The lobby's heat is intense and close, but kind of porous. It's in a sort of uneasy struggle with the radiant chill of all the smoked glass of the entrance. The lamps out in the lot and off along the driveway are blobs of sepia light through the glass. Inside, cove lighting at the seams of walls and ceiling produce an indirect light that's shadowless and seems to rise from the room's objects themselves. It's the same lighting and lion-colored carpeting in the first long hall Hal tries. The room numbers go up to 17, and then, after Hal turns a sharp corner, start at 34A. The room doors are false blonde wood, but look thick and private, flush in their frames. There's also the smell of stale coffee. The walls' color scheme is somewhere between puce and mature eggplant skin, kind of nauseous against the sandy tan of the carpet. All buildings with any kind of health theme to them have this thin, sick, sweet, dental subodor to them. QRS also seems to have some sort of balsamy air freshener going in the ventilation system, too, but it doesn't quite cover the sweet medical stink or the bland, sour smell of institutional food. Hal hasn't heard one human sound since he came in. The place's silence has that glittery sound of total silence. His footfalls make no sound on the dacrenile. He feels furtive and burglarish, and holds the NASA glass down at his side and the NA booklet higher up and cover out as a sort of explanatory ID. There are computer-enhanced landscapes on the walls, little low tables with glossy pamphlets, a framed print of Picasso's Seated Harlequin, and nothing else that wasn't just institutional bullshit. Visual muzak. Without any sound to his footfalls, it's like The gauntlets of doors just glide by. The quiet has a kind of menace. The whole cubular building seems to howl to hold the tensed menace of a living thing that's chosen to hold itself still. If you asked Hal to describe his feelings as he looked for room 32A, the best he could do would be to say he wished he were somewhere else and feeling some way besides how he felt. His mouth pours spit. The glass is one-third full and heavy in his hand and not much fun to look at. He's missed the glass a couple of times and marred the tan carpet with dark spit. After 2 90-degree turns, it's clear the hallway's run is a perfect square around the cube's ground level. He's seen no stairs or entrances to stairways. He empties the NASA glass rather gooily into a potted rubber tree's dirt. QRS's building may be one of those infamous rubicular cubes that looks topologically undeformed but is actually impossible to negotiate on the inside. But the numbers after the third corner start at 18, and now Hal can hear either very distant or very muffled voices. He carries the NA booklet in front of him like a crucifix. He has about $50 U.S. and another $100 in eagle, leaf, and broom-emblemized ONAN script, having had no idea what sort of introductory costs might be involved. QRS didn't purchase prime Natick acreage, and the cutting-edge services of a Sao Paulo school geometric minimalist architect with just altruistic goodwill, that was for sure. Room 32A's wooden grain door was just as emphatically shut as all the others, but the muffled voices were behind this one. The meeting was listed in the book as starting at 1730, and it was only around 1720, and Hal thought the voices might signify some sort of pre-meeting orientation for people who've come for the first time, sort of tentatively, just to scout the whole enterprise out, so he doesn't knock. He still has this intractable habit of making a move like he's straightening a bow tie before he enters a strange room. And except for the thin rubber sheaths, the doorknobs on the Quabbin Recovery System's doors are the same as at ETA. Flat bars of brass toggle bolted to the latch mechanism, so you have to push the bar down instead of turning anything to open the door. But the meeting is underway, apparently. It isn't near big enough to create a mood of anonymity or casual spectation. 9 or 10 adult middle-class males are in the warm room on orange plastic chairs with legs of molded steel tubing. Every one of the men has a beard, and each wears chinos and a sweater, and they all sit the same way, that Indian cross-legged style with their hands on their knees and their feet under their knees, and they all wear socks with no footwear or winter jackets anywhere in sight. Hal eases the door shut and sort of slinks along the wall to an empty chair, all the time conspicuously brandishing the meeting booklet. The chairs are placed in no discernible order, and their orange clashes nastily with the room's own colors, walls and ceiling the color of Thousand Island dressing, a color scheme with unplaceable but uneasy associations for Hal, and more of the lionskin Dacronal carpet. And the warm air in 32A is stuffy with CO2 and unpleasantly scented with the aroma of soft male middle-aged bodies not wearing footwear, a stale, meaty, cheesy smell, more nauseous even than the ETA locker room after a Mrs. Clark Tex-Mex fiesta. The only guy in the meeting to acknowledge Hal's entrance is at the front of the room, a man Hal would have to call almost morbidly round, his body nearly leaf-sized and globularly round, and the smaller but still large globe of a head atop it, his socks plaid, and his legs not all the way crossable, so it looks like he might pitch disastrously backward in his chair any minute, smiling warmly at Hal's winter coat and NASA glass, as Hal slinks and sits and slumps down low. The round man's chair is positioned under a small white magic marker blackboard, and all the other chairs approximately face it. And the man holds a magic marker in one hand and holds what looks quite a bit like a teddy bear to his chest with the other, and wears chinos and a cable-knit Norwegian sweater the color of toast. His hair is that waxy sort of blonde, and he's got the blonde eyebrows and creepy blonde eyelashes and violently flushed face of a true Norwegian blonde. and his little beard is an imperial so sharply waxed it looks like a truncated star. The morbidly round, blonde man's pretty clearly the leader of the meeting, possibly a high-ranking official of Narcotics Anonymous, whom Hal could casually approach about tracts and texts to buy and study afterward. Another middle-aged guy up near the front is crying, and he too holds what looks like a bear. The blonde brows hike up and down as the leader says,
"I'd like to suggest we men all hold our bears tight and let our inner infant non-judgmentally listen to Kevin's inner infant expressing his grief and loss."
They're all at subtly different angles to Hal, who slumped low over by the wall in the second-to-last row. But it turns out, after some subtle, casual neck craning, that, sure enough, all these middle-class guys, in at least their 30s, are sitting there clutching teddy bears to their sweatered chests. And identical teddy bears, plump and brown and splay-limbed and with a little red corduroy tongue protruding from the mouths, so the bears all look oddly throttled. The room is menacingly quiet now except for the sibilance of the heating vents and the sobbing guy Kevin and the plip of Hal's saliva hitting the bottom of the empty glass rather more loudly than he might have wished. The back of the crying guy's neck is turning redder and redder as he clutches his bear and rocks on his hams. Hal sits with his leg crossed, good ankle on knee, and joggles his white high top and looks at his calloused thumb and listens to the Kevin guy sob and snuffle. The guy wipes his nose with the heel of his hand, just like the littler buddies at ETA. Hal figures the tears and bears have something to do with giving up drugs, and that the meeting is probably on the verge of coming around to talking explicitly about drugs and how to give up drugs for a certain period without feeling indescribably wretched and bereft, or maybe at least some data on how long one might expect the wretchedness of giving up drugs to continue before the old nervous system and salivary glands return to normal. Even though inner infant sounds uncomfortably close to Dr. Dolores Rusk's dreaded inner child, Hal'd be willing to bet that here it's some sort of shorthand, Narcotics Anonymous sobriquet for, like, limbic component of the CNS, or the part of our cortex that's not utterly wretched and bereft without the drugs that up to now have been pulling us through the day secretly, or some affirming, encouraging thing like that. Hal wills himself to stay objective and not form any judgments before he has serious data, hoping desperately for some sort of hopeful feeling to emerge. The diglobular leader has made a cage of his hands and rested his hands on his teddy bear's head and is breathing slowly and evenly, watching Kevin kindly from under the blonde eyebrows, looking more than anything like some sort of Buddha-esque California surfer dude. The leader inhales gently and says,
"The energies I'm feeling in the group are energies of unconditional love and acceptance for Kevin's inner infant."
Nobody else says anything, and the leader doesn't seem to need anybody to say anything. He looks down at the cage his hands have made on the bear and keeps subtly changing the shape of the cage. The guy Kevin, whose neck is now not only beet red but shiny with embarrassed sweat between his shirt collar and hair's hem, sobs even harder at the affirmation of love and support. The round leader's high, hoarse voice had the same blandly kind, didactic quality as Rusk's, as if always speaking to a not-too-bright child. After some more cage play and deep breathing, the leader looks up and around and nods at nothing and says,
"Maybe we could all name our feelings right now for Kevin and share how much we're caring for him and his inner infant right now, in his pain."
Various bearded, cross-legged guys speak up.
"I love you, Kevin."
"I'm not judging you, Kevin."
"No, just how you and the I feel."
"I'm feeling really close to you."
"I'm feeling a lot of love for you right now, Kevin."
"You're crying for two, guy."
"Kevin, Kevin, 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 Kevin. I'm not feeling like your crying is one bit unmanly or pathetic, fella."
It's at this point that Hal begins truly to lose his willed objectivity and open-mindedness, and to get a bad personal feeling about this narcotics, anonymous NA meeting, which seems already deeply underway and isn't one bit like he's imagined an even remotely hopeful anti-drug meeting would be like. It seems more like some kind of cosmetic psychology encounter thing. Not one substance or symptom of substance deprivation has been mentioned so far. And none of these guys looks like they've ever been engaged with anything more substantial than an occasional wine cooler, if he had to guess. Hal's grim mood deepens as the round man up front now leans precariously over and down and opens a sort of toy box under the blackboard by his chair and produces a cheap plastic portable CD laser scanner and sets it on top of the toy box, where it begins to issue a kind of low, treacly, ambient shopping mall music, mostly cello, with sporadic harps and chimes. The stuff spreads through the hot little room like melted butter, and Hal sinks lower in his orange chair and looks hard at the space and spacecraft emblem on his NASA glass.
"Kevin,"
the leader says over the music.
"Kevin."
The sobbing man's hand lies over his face like a spider, and he doesn't even start to look up until the leader has said several times very blandly and kindly,
"Kevin, do you feel okay about looking at the rest of the group?"
Kevin's red neck wrinkles as he looks up at the blonde leader through his fingers. The leader's made the cage again on his poor bear's squashed head.
"Can you share what you're feeling, Kevin?"
he says.
"Can you name it?"
Kevin's voice is muffled by the hand he hides behind.
"I'm feeling my inner infants, abandonment, and deep deprivation issues, Harv,"
he says, drawing shuddering breaths. His mauve sweater's shoulders tremble.
"I'm feeling my inner infant standing, holding the bars of his crib and looking out of the bars. Bars of his crib and crying for his mommy and daddy to come hold him and nurture him."
Kevin sobs twice in an apneated way. One arm holds his lapsed bear so tight Hal thinks he can see a little stuffing start to come out of its mouth around its tongue. And a stalactite of that clear, thin, weepy-type mucus hangs from Kevin's nose just millimeters over the throttled bear's head.
"And nobody's coming,"
he sobs.
"Nobody's coming. I feel alone with my bear and plastic airplane mobile and teething ring."
Everybody's nodding in an affirming and pained way. No two beards are exactly the same fullness and design. A couple other sobs break out across the room. Everyone's bear stares blankly ahead. The leader's nod is slow and meditative.
"And can you share your needs with the group right now, Kevin?"
"Please share, Kevin," says a slim guy over by a black filing cabinet who sits like he's a veteran at sitting Indian style in hard plastic chairs. The music's still going, going absolutely nowhere, like Philip Glass on Quaaludes.
"The work we're here to do,"
the leader says over the music, one hand now pressed pensively to the side of his big face,
"is to work on our dysfunctional passivity and tendency to wait silently for our inner infant's needs to be magically met. The energy I feel in the group now is that the group is supportively asking Kevin to nurture his inner infant by naming and sharing his needs out loud with the group. And I'm feeling how aware we all are, how risky and vulnerable need naming out loud must feel for Kevin right now."
Everybody looks deadly serious. A couple guys are rubbing their bears' bellies pregnantly. The only really infantile thing Hal can feel inside him is the inguinal gurgle of two heavy bran muffins swallowed at high speeds without liquid. The string of mucus from Kevin's nose trembles and swings. The slender guy who'd asked Kevin, please, to share, is now waggling the arms of his teddy bear in an infantile way. Hal feels a wave of nausea flood his mouth with fresh saliva.
We're asking you to name what your inner infant wants right now more than anything in the world.
The leader's saying to Kevin.
To be loved. And held.
Kevin keens, sobbing harder. His lacrimucus is now a thin silver string joining his nose and the fuzzy top of his bear's head. The bear's expression is seeming creepier to Hal by the second. Hal wonders what the etiquette is in N.A. about getting up and leaving right in the middle of somebody's infantile revelation of need. Meanwhile, Kevin is saying that his inner infant inside him had always hoped that someday his mom and dad would be there for him, to hold him and love him. He says, but right from the start, they'd never been there for him, leaving him and his brother with Hispanic nannies while they devoted themselves to their jobs and various types of psychotherapy and support groups. This takes a while to say, given all the snuffles and racked spasms. Then Kevin says, but then by the time he was 8, they were gone altogether, dead, smooshed, by a dysfunctionally falling radio traffic helicopter on the Jamaica Way, on the way to couples counseling. At this, Hal's slumped head jerks up, his mouth oval with horror. He's all of a sudden realized that this guy who's seated at such an angle that Hal's been able to see only the obliquest portion of his profile is in fact Kevin Bain, his brother Oren's old ETA doubles and chemical mischief partner, Marlon Bain's older brother, Kevin Bain, of Dedham, Massachusetts, who, the last Hal had heard, had gotten his MBA at Wharton and cleaned up with a string of simulated reality arcades all up and down the South Shore, back during the pre-subsidized time simulated reality craze, before interlace viewers and digital cartridges let you do your own customized simulating right at home and the novelty wore off.
335.
The Kevin Bain whose childhood hobby was memorizing IRS capital depreciation schedules and whose adult idea of a wild time
336.
Had been putting extra marshmallows in his nightly coca, and who wouldn't have known a recreational drug if it walked up and poked him in the eye. Hal begins to scan for possible exits. The only door was the one he'd come in, which is in full view of most of the room. There are no windows at all. Hal's chilled by multiple realization. This is no N.A. or anti-substance meeting. This is one of those men's issues, men's movement type meetings Katie Coyle's stepdad went to, and Coyle liked to mimic and parody during drills, making his stick's grip poke out between his legs and yelling, "Nurture this! Honor getting in touch with this!" Kevin Bain is wiping his nose with his poor teddy bear's head and saying it didn't look like his inner infant would ever get its wish. The gooey music's cello sounds like some sort of cow mooing in distress, maybe at what it's in the middle of. Sure enough, the round man, whose hands left a print on his soft cheek, asks poor old Kevin Bain to honor and name his eye's wounded wish anyway. To say, "Please, Mommy and Daddy, come love and hold me," out loud several times, which Kevin Bain goes ahead and does, rocking a little in his chair, his voice now with an edge of good old adult mortified embarrassment to it, along with the racking sobs. A couple of the other men in the room are wiping at their bright white drug-free eyes with the arms of their teddy bears. Hal is painfully reminded of the rare Ziplocs of Humboldt County hydroponic marijuana that Pemulus occasionally scored via FedEx from his mercantile counterpart at the Rolling Hills Academy. The curved tawny buds so big and plump with high Delta-9 resin, the Ziplocs had looked like bags of little teddy bear arms. The moist sounds right behind him turn out to be a mild-faced older man eating yogurt out of a plastic cup. Hal keeps rechecking the meeting data in the little MBRO booklet the girl had given him. He notes that the booklet has broad chocolate thumbprints on several of the pages, and that two pages are stuck firmly together with what Hal fears is an ancient dried booger. And now that the booklet's cover is dated January in the year of dairy products from the American heartland, that is nearly 2 years past, and that it's not impossible that the blandly, hostile, toothless girl at the Ennett facility had kertwanged him by giving him a dated and useless
MBRO Guide. Kevin Bain keeps repeating, "Please, Mommy and Daddy, come love me and hold me," in a kind of monotone of pathos. The gradually intensifying lisp in "please" is apparently a performative invocation of the old inner infant. Tears and other fluids